Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. I'm excited today to have Wayne Hauser on the show. He's 90 years young, and I really do mean 90 years young. If you saw him walk into the studio today, you would understand what I'm talking about. He gets around very well for his age. He's been on my list for quite some time, and I guess I just had to wait till he was 90 to get him on the program. I'm glad he's here today. If you're not a regular listener to this program, you should know that what we do here is we talk to World War II veterans about their experiences, and the idea behind it is to honor them for their service, for their sacrifice, to remember what they did, preserve those stories for posterity, and hopefully maybe along the way we'll be inspired to love our country the way that they did and still do all these years after World War II. Wayne Hauser, a World War II veteran of the U.S. Army Air Corps. But let's go back a little before that, Wayne. I mentioned you're 90 years old. So in 1941, December 7th, you had just celebrated your 21st birthday a few days before that. Maybe we're still recovering from the celebration on December 7th. What do you remember about that day and how you found out that America was at war?
Well, that's very interesting. I do remember that day. I think most everyone does. Remember where they were and what they were doing. I had moved back to Kansas City, where I was born and raised, and my mother had come back from California to visit. And while she was there, we went over to the old neighborhood and to visit friends. Mm-hmm. And we were next door to the home that I had grown up in, visiting a party that was still living there. And somehow or other, she had the radio on low, playing music, I think. And they broke into the program to announce that Pearl Harbor had been bombed. And it's something that a person just, it stays in your mind when something of such significance happens.
Mm-hmm.
That I think everyone could, most everyone could account for what they were doing on that particular day.
And it sounds like you maybe even can still hear in your head what that radio broadcast sounded like and what they were saying.
Yes, yes.
Did it
register? President Roosevelt made the announcement.
So you remember hearing President Roosevelt the day after talking about what Japan had done.
I felt very privileged because I'd had the privilege of seeing President Roosevelt a few years before when I was in the Boy Scouts. We had the Honor Troop of the City in 1934.
Mm-hmm.
And we were privileged to act as ushers when he came to town at the big municipal auditorium there in Kansas City.
How about that?
Yeah.
So this was a much different scenario that he was speaking to you under, and you were an older man, probably feeling a little more responsibility at 21 than you had as a young Boy Scout.
Yeah.
Did it register immediately that this is something you might be involved in?
I'm sure it did. I'm sure it did.
When did you make that decision that the U.S. Army Air Corps was where you wanted to be?
I had taken my brother down when he was on his 17th birthday to join the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
I was in California at the time. I had been giving it serious thoughts ever since. And I did try to join the Navy, and I tried to join the Marine Corps. And it's kind of a situation. In neither one of those branches could I pass the physical.
What was the problem?
Well, one was eyesight and one was ear problems.
Uh-huh.
And so, well, all right, I'll probably have to wait till I get drafted.
All right.
And that came about. It was a situation that I couldn't hardly bring myself to understand. I was accepted into the Air Corps and put on flying status.
Which is usually the first one that's going to bounce you for an eye problem or an ear problem.
Right, right, right.
I guess when they need you, huh?
Apparently so. Apparently so.
Well, and once that happened, did you have aspirations of flying planes? Did you think maybe you'd end up as a pilot?
No. Somehow or other, I really didn't care to go into pilot training. I was given the opportunity, but I was sent to Jefferson Barracks, Missouri, outside of St. Louis, for my pre-training.
Mm-hmm.
And in as much as I'd taken ROTC in high school, well, I got out a lot of my basic training, and I was given the choice of going to various schools. I selected a radio school to go to.
What was the driving force behind that decision? Just sounded exciting or interesting to
you?
Well,
I'd talked to a buddy who had been home on leave,
mm-hmm.
and he had gone to radio school, and I talked to him about it, and he was happy that he had been there and was proceeding on with his service. And so when I saw that offered, well, I jumped at it, and I was accepted.
So you had an idea right then and there that when you did make it up into the air that you'd be in a fairly sizable plane, most likely.
Of course.
If you're a radio officer, you're going to be in one of the bombers.
Yeah.
So what was that like when the training progressed and you finally got to ride in one of these big flying boats, or, well, they weren't PBYs or anything, I don't want to mislead, but a flying anvil, perhaps, I guess you eventually ended up in. What was that experience like for a kid from Kansas City who probably hadn't spent a ton of time up in an airplane?
I'd been up one time on a pleasure flight.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, prior to that, yeah.
This was a little different?
Well this was still several months away from that particular point.
Sure.
Yeah. After going to radio school in Sioux Falls, that went on for about 4 months, and then we were given the opportunity of many other schools, including pilot training again. Among the offers were a gunnery school. I was gung-ho at the time, and by going to gunnery school, I knew then that I could qualify for a position on an aircrew.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the way I went. I attended gunnery school up in Wendover, Utah, up in the mountains in the wintertime.
Mm.
And our home was nothing but the old CCC barracks that they had many years before. And just nothing but tar paper over framework.
Deluxe accommodations to keep you warm, huh?
Yeah, yeah. We had a potbelly stove in the middle of this thing, 40 guys in one of these tar paper
just a little
housings.
Shack.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
In the mountains in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a fire guard all night long, had to keep that potbelly stove going. And at 5:30 in the morning, the whistle blew, and we had to be standing outside in formation 2 minutes later. So all we could get on was our boots and our big OD overcoats and stand in line. So then the procedure started. Had to walk up and down that mountain prior to chow call.
Mm.
It was as tough as any place I ever saw overseas.
Well, they're just breaking you in, huh?
I'll see.
Getting you ready for flying at altitude without the pressurized cabin and accommodations that we know today. So that sounds like quite the adventure. I'm sure that's exactly what you were looking forward to when they drafted you, marching up and down in the freezing cold.
Very interesting.
So from that, if that is your training, you were probably ready to go and get out of there and get up in a plane somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where did they take you next?
Gunnery school was a lot of fun.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure
we got to do a lot of target shooting. And
was that an adjustment for you at first? Because I'm sure if you'd ever fired a gun before, you're probably stationary while you're firing it. You don't have to account for not only the movement of your aircraft, but the movement of the target. What was that like for you? Did you pick that up right away, or did it take a while?
it came naturally, pretty much. When I was growing up, I went hunting with my father a lot, and he taught me how to lead to get those rabbits.
And that came in handy in the air, I guess.
Yes, it did.
Just lead the target.
Yeah.
And before long, you'd be hunting the Luftwaffe across the pond. But we need to take a break right now, our first commercial break here on Hometown Heroes. When we come back, much more with Wayne Hauser. We'll get him to tell us how he earned the Distinguished Flying Cross, what happened to his crew a day that he didn't go on the mission. I think you'll be very intrigued by that story as well. Many stories to come from Wayne Hauser, 90 years old, our guest today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
You're listening to Wild Blue Yonder because our guest today, Wayne Hauser, is an Army Air Corps veteran of World War II, and the Wild Blue Yonder sounded a lot more alluring than the freezing mountains of Wendover, Utah, as you heard him describing before we took our first commercial break. Wayne is now 90 years old, lives in Fresno, California. You might know him down in Visalia as well. And a few years ago, Representative Devin Nunes helped him get some of his medals back after many years. He is a recipient of the Distinguished Flying Cross, as well as the Purple Heart, among others. So we'll get those stories out of him. But first, I want to ask you, Wayne, I know you got over there pretty early in terms of the veterans that I've interviewed who were in the Air Corps in World War II. You were actually in Europe by September of 1943, which is fairly early on in the air war there from an American perspective. I've got to ask you, what was it like heading over? Because here you'd had this buildup. You tried to get in the Navy and the Marine Corps. They didn't want you because of your eyes and your ears. Lo and behold, you end up in the Army Air Corps. And now you're finally heading overseas, and you know that the combat is coming. What was your mindset? Were you kind of antsy to get over there, or were you starting to say, boy, I don't know what this is going to be like?
No, I was gung-ho. I was ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
Our staging area was in Lincoln, Nebraska. We proceeded via train to...
Maybe some of those air missions are more memorable than a train ride.
Yeah, yeah.
Domestically.
Anyway, we...
You got overseas by September of 43, and by this time you'd been assigned to a bomb group, the 376 bomb group, and I'm sure you even had the crew that you expected to be flying with, right?
Yeah. We flew over, two crews of us flew over with our equipment on a what was a C-54. It was the Army version of the DC-4.
Mm-hmm.
And we left Presque Isle, Maine, made one stop in Stevensville, Newfoundland for gas, and proceeded the next day between layers all the way to Prestwick, Scotland.
Mm.
Not seeing anything but clouds until we were over Scotland, and we started our descent. And we spent a couple of weeks in Scotland for further briefing and training prior to being sent by train down to a English manor.
Mm-hmm.
As I remember it as Sheddington, England. It was about 10, 15 miles out of London.
All right.
Where we got some more schooling. It was a beautiful area. And we were assigned to the 8th Air Force. When we were through with our schooling and our briefings and all, we were given orders to leave England, not knowing where we were going. We departed England under secret orders, just our crew alone, in what was in a DC-3, affectionately known as a Goonie Bird, and just our crew with our equipment. We took off not knowing where we were going. We made a fuel stop in the island of Malta, and from there we proceeded to North Africa, and we were flying low level, about 50 feet above the ground, over the sandy beaches of North Africa, where Rommel and what was
Montgomery?
Montgomery had been chasing one another back and forth for a while.
Right. So just to put it in perspective for our listeners, this is still 9-10 months before D-Day. The European invasion has not started yet from an Allied perspective, and the hot spot is North Africa, where Rommel and Montgomery, as you said, have been chasing each other around the desert.
Yeah, and we could observe all the carnage and wreckage over the desert. And after we left the Isle of Malta, why, Frechette, our flight captain, was able to open the sealed orders and found out we were headed for Benghazi, Libya.
All right.
In support of the 8th Air Force there, who had been out in Benghazi practicing for that first low-level raid over Ploesti is what I was looking
for. Oh, the Ploesti oil fields in Romania.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. The 8th Air Force had been down there practicing low-level flying for that first low-level raid over Ploesti, Romania, the oil fields. And that's when we found out that we were being sent there as a replacement crew, because they had made that first low-level raid on August 1 of 43, and it took one heck of a beating.
Right.
Lost a lot of crews. A good many of them were lost due to the cables holding the balloons over the oil factories.
Right.
And the outfit that we were being assigned to had led that raid over.
So they had been decimated.
Over Ploesti. And like I say, they took a terrible beating. Our commanding officer there was outfitted with a B-24 that had been outfitted with special armor plating and all to carry the commanding general in the right seat. By the scraps of information we could pick up from talking to the fellows about it after we got there, the general, who's sitting right seat next to our commanding officer, who was a full bird colonel at 28, and by the way, he was from St. Joseph, Missouri.
Not too far from you.
No, that's right.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, General Rent says to our commanding officer, who was flying the left seat, "Let's get the hell out of here." This was after he had seen what was going on, and it turned out that after returning to the base, why, the few of them that returned needed a lot of reinforcements, so that's why we were sent out there. And I ended up flying my first mission then on September the 9th of 1943 over Foggia, Italy.
Mm-hmm.
The way the 376 worked it, when new crews came over, why, they would split up a crew and have us fly with experienced crews for the first three or four missions.
Right.
And I flew with a fellow that day who had spent 3 days in the Mediterranean hanging on to part of the fuselage of the airplane that went down. He was the only survivor.
And that was on the Ploesti raid?
And when he was
shot
picked
down
up 3 days later, well, he was given the option of returning to the States. He said no. He says, "I'm going to stay and complete my tour."
Wow.
And what a guy.
Anyway, I guess so. That's a good guy to think.
I felt privileged to be able to fly my first mission with such a guy as that.
I don't blame you.
And we flew over Foggia, Italy.
And this is a B-24.
This is a B-24.
And where are you on the plane?
Well, on that particular mission, I went along just as an observer.
All right.
And that's the way they broke us in.
Mm-hmm.
And the mission came off without any particular enemy action and all. And I thought, boy, this is a piece of cake.
That would change, wouldn't it?
Yes, definitely. Anyway, after a few missions like that with everyone on the crew, we got back together flying. Now, this was different for me because I had not gone through flight training. And my combat training with these guys, they were all new to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because the crew that I had trained with, if you want to go back a little bit.
I don't have a problem with that, but we are up against another commercial here. So let's take a break, and then we'll catch up to where we are in the story of Wayne Hauser. Still to come, a very memorable Christmas many years ago. And also how he earned the Distinguished Flying Cross, why he can also wear a purple heart. Wayne Hauser, our guest today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Time to continue with Wayne Hauser, 90 years old. You might know him from Fresno or Visalia if you live around the San Joaquin Valley. But many, many years ago, he was over the skies of Europe serving with the 376th Bomb Group in a squadron of B-24s. He started to tell us a little bit about that, and he was going to explain why he wasn't with the crew that he trained with. So we'll try to race through that explanation here if we can, Wayne. Before you guys headed overseas, they said you've got 10 days to go wherever you want. And you came out to California, then stopped in Kansas City on your way back. But some of the officers on your crew decided to go somewhere else, and it didn't go as planned.
Yeah.
What happened to them?
They decided to rent a car and go to Topeka. Apparently, one of them had some interest in Topeka, Kansas, which was not too far from Lincoln, Nebraska.
Uh-huh.
And either going or coming back, they had an automobile accident, ended up in the hospital.
So they couldn't go overseas.
So the rest of us guys there in Lincoln, the staging areas, we didn't know what was going to happen. We figured, well, we'd probably be split up maybe or maybe kept together and trained with a new cockpit crew for a few weeks. So I immediately contacted what was to be my better half.
Uh-huh.
And told her we could go ahead and get married.
Because you thought you'd be around for a little while longer.
I was told that we'd probably be around for a few more months training with another crew.
Uh-huh.
Well, after I'd made that commitment to her, and which she was all for it, I got a tap on my shoulder from a pilot of one of the crews that we had trained with for the last 3 months. He says, Wayne, he says, I need you. He says, my radio operator is in the hospital, and I've got orders to go to the South Pacific.
Mm.
He says, but I need a radio operator.
All right.
He says, you're it. I said, no. You don't you don't want me. I says, I'm going to get married.
Uh-huh.
He says, tell me about it. So I did. He says, I'll tell you what. He says, I'll get you one-day pass, 24-hour pass. He says, you can get married. Mm-hmm. He says, but you're going with me. We've already got our orders. We've already got our equipment. And there was no way I could get out of it. I got my one-day pass, and we got the knot tied.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure she was thrilled that you were leaving the next day.
That's something else. So after the ceremony, her father, along with a few friends, by the way, we were married in the living room of their home in Omaha, Nebraska.
All right.
And her dad took us out to a chicken dinner that night and handed me the keys. He had a 41 Oldsmobile and handed me the keys. He says, don't miss that right turn on the way back to Lincoln. So, of course, I missed it. But we got to Lincoln and stayed at the Cornhusker Hotel.
Of course.
For our wedding night. The next morning, I had to report in at the base at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
I bid her goodbye, and I says, I understand we're going by train, and we'll be coming through Omaha. I says, if you can make it back there in time, come down to the station. She says, I'll introduce you to my crew.
How about that?
And she did, and I did, and then I was back on the train heading for Presque Isle, Maine.
Talk about a whirlwind.
Yeah. Now here's what's ironic about it.
All right.
We get to Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Frechette takes us all off of the train. He's our pilot, our first pilot.
Right.
He lives in Presque Isle, in just outside of Boston.
All right.
So his sister meets him at the train depot, and he takes us to a first-class hotel near the Boston Common and puts us up for the night, and he takes off with his sister to go home for the night.
Right.
So he's back there the next morning. We're back on the train heading for Presque Isle, Maine.
Mm-hmm.
Like I mentioned before, why we were put on a C-54, the Army version of the DC-4.
Yeah.
And we got to travel first class. It had not been converted yet, so we even had stewardesses on there to take care of our food needs and anything else we needed. And
that's the way to go.
Yeah.
A little more accommodating than a B-24 in combat.
Yes, yes.
So eventually you get over there, and as you mentioned, the crew that you trained with is not the crew that you're with now, but you have this pilot, Frechette, who you start to build a lot of confidence in.
Yes, right.
And for our listeners who aren't familiar with a B-24 and what you would be doing on these missions, what was not that any mission's typical, but what was a mission like for you from your combat position on that B-24?
Okay. My position on the B-24 was as a radio operator. And the radio position was on the flight deck right behind the cockpit on a B-24.
Right.
In that position as a radio operator, procedure was to maintain radio silence all the way to the target.
Right.
And then only the lead aircraft, radio operator on the lead aircraft, After departing the target, dropping our bomb load, and leaving enemy territory, the radio operator would contact the home base and give them a brief description of how the mission went, and as far as he could figure out, the number of aircraft returning. And other than that, our position was manning the turret, and the top turret set just above the flight deck on the B-24. So that was my position where I spent 90% of my time.
And anyone who's seen a B-24 can picture that turret, knows what he's talking about. And I imagine you have a pretty interesting perspective from there. You can't see anything below the airplane.
Like a ringside seat mm-hmm. to what was going on.
Well, and when you fly 50 missions, I guess you probably see quite a bit.
We did.
You talked about early on your missions. I understand one of the most memorable missions or situations that you encountered came right around Christmas, just a couple months after you'd gotten there. You just had your birthday in early December of 43, and then Christmas rolls around. I'm sure you were expecting some special celebration, and they wanted you to go to work, huh?
True story. We had a mission scheduled for Christmas Day.
Mm-hmm.
And my crew was not scheduled to fly. A buddy of mine on another crew was scheduled to fly, and he came around on Christmas Eve, and he says, Wayne, he says, I know you don't drink. He says, I would like to celebrate. I would like to have a few drinks. He says, and I'm scheduled to fly tomorrow. He says, would you mind flying my position? I says, well, Charlie, let me check it out. I checked with Frechette. He says, no problem. So that made Charlie happy. He could go ahead and celebrate Christmas Eve.
So your pilot of your crew had released you to go fly with this other crew.
That's right. That's uh-huh. right, which I did.
All right.
And our mission that day was a target up in northern Italy in the Alps, a ball-bearing factory. And Charlie's position on his plane with his crew was a waist position. So I assumed that position for the day. We were not the lead aircraft. We had no need for a radio operation.
So you've got a little different perspective here from the waist.
I did mm-hmm. from the right waist position, and it was a beautiful day, Christmas Day over the Alps, snow covered Alps. We got up there, and we found we were flying over an undercast. The whole formation of 17 aircraft that day.
Mm-hmm.
We dropped our targets, our bombs, with absolutely no enemy opposition at all. We dropped them through the undercast, and made a 180 and returned to her base with absolutely no enemy action.
Mm-hmm.
Got back to the base, had a great Christmas dinner. But after each mission, while we're debriefed, and the flight surgeon is also in on a debriefing, he discovered that I'd gotten some frostbite from flying that waist position. It was 40 below zero that day.
40 below zero.
40 below zero.
Now, I went to school in upstate New York where it's below zero every once in a while. You get cold, and I felt that cold on my face. Yeah. But 40 below zero?
Yeah, and we were just under 25,000 feet.
Yeah, the altitude is a big factor in that.
That's right, a big factor.
But you just described the mission, said you had no problem, and you got back home.
That's right.
You didn't feel any of this?
It wasn't bugging you? It's cold. It's cold. You just know it's cold. We've got heated flying suits, but it's cold.
Right.
And we've got connections for our gloves and for our boots.
Uh-huh.
And that heated flying suit is nice when it's working. When it goes out, it's not so nice.
But your face had been exposed.
That's right.
Through that waist position.
That's right.
All right.
And he says, Wayne, he says, I'm going to have to ground you for 10 days. He says, it'll take that long for that to heal up. I said, no.
You didn't want to miss out flying with
crew. That's right. I says, that can't be. He says, don't worry about it. He says, there'll always be plenty of missions. Okay, so now I'm grounded. On the 26th of December, they fly a P-38 up there, a recon mission, to check the target, and the target was still standing.
Mm-hmm.
When we dropped our bombs through the undercast, they missed the target.
Not surprisingly, sure.
And so on the 28th, why, we were scheduled to fly the same mission.
But you can't go because of the frostbite on your face.
That's right. Another fellow flew in my position, an Italian kid. As it happened, they had a breakdown in communications on the way up there. The mission was called off. Our 98th Bomb Group, which was our sister group, turned back. Our P-38 escort turned back, and the 376 did not get the word.
Mm-hmm.
So we had one aircraft out of the 18 that we put up there turned back because of a malfunction. So that left 17 B-24s over the target, my crew among them, and they were met by a flight of Hermann Göring's Yellow Nose outfit,
mm-hmm.
which consisted of 109s and Focke-Wulf 190s,
so
200 of them.
200 fighter planes from the German Luftwaffe hunting down B-24s that are flying without escort.
17 B-24s.
That is a mismatch if I've ever heard of one. Unfortunately, we need to take our final break right here. But when we come back, we're going to find out what happened on that fateful mission that Wayne missed out on. But I think you'll be very intrigued by how this story works out. We'll get the rest of Wayne's exploits as well with the 376th Bomb Group in World War II. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I apologize for the cliffhanger there. When we left off, Wayne Hauser was describing the mission that he couldn't go on with his B-24 crew, where he was normally a radio man and turret gunner in the front of that aircraft, at least the top just behind the cockpit. He was grounded because of frostbite on his face when he had filled in a waist gunner position on another mission with another crew. And he talked about the situation where his crew went up, the mission was called off, but 17 B-24s of the 376th Bomb Group were still heading for the target, unaware that the mission had been called off because of communication problems. And they were met in the sky by no fewer than 200 German fighter planes. Just hearing that, I'm sure everyone at home knows what's going to happen here. The B-24s are not going to make out too well in this. But why don't you tell us, Wayne, how it all worked out?
Yeah, needless to say, the sky was filled with parachutes. Out of the 17 B-24s, 7 aircraft returned. 10 B-24s shot down that day. And my crew was among them. And in the debriefing from the crews that got back, why, supposedly they were 10 chutes came out of my crew's airplane.
Mm-hmm.
But in such a situation as that, why, there are some errors, and not everything is as it is said.
Reports are not always accurate.
They're not accurate. That's right. Well, we come to find out that our bombardier and our navigator, their position was in the nose of the aircraft. They did not get out. All eight of the others got out, and they were taken prisoners of war. They spent 2.5 years in one of Hitler's Stalag prisons.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to state the obvious.
After 2.5 years, they all made it home safely.
Well, thank the Lord for that.
Yes.
And there's a real neat aspect to that story that I want to get to. But first, I have to state the obvious for our audience. That could have been you, maybe should have been you, that was shot down that day. But it wasn't. And I know I heard you say a few minutes ago that the fickle finger of fate.
Yeah. You just don't know. That's about the only way it can be classified. It happened to me so many times. I feel like that I've had so much luck in my life that there's no accounting for it. It just happens.
Somebody was looking out for you.
Apparently so. Yeah, and I credit the good Lord.
I'm not going to argue with you with that. And yeah. I wonder if maybe that wife who you were married to for all of a day before you went overseas was saying a few prayers for you back home too.
I'm sure that had a lot to do with it.
So how did that occur to you, though, on the ground? How did you process that when you heard, here's a mission that you wanted to be on, that you couldn't be on because of the frostbite to your face, and all your friends are missing? You don't know what happened to them.
Yeah. We assumed that they had all been taken POWs.
Right.
Which turned out that we were right. They ended up one of the Stalag Bluff prisons over there for 2.5 years. Which an interesting sidelight, I talked to my pilot 2004, just prior to the dedication of the war memorial, of the World War II memorial back in D.C.
Which everyone should visit when you have a chance.
So my son was good enough to set me up with a contact with Lieutenant Frechette, and I got him on the wire, and he told me he was a CPA, and he had two sons working for him in the office. He told me about his captivity, how he was treated okay. He and his co-pilot were together in the POW camp for that many years.
And this, I want to clarify for our listeners, you had not spoken to Lieutenant Frechette since he was shot down.
That's right.
Just after Christmas 1943.
That's right.
So this is more than 60 years that go by.
That's right.
And you guys are reunited. That had to be an unforgettable moment just to talk to him again.
It was. We talked for, I'll bet you, a good 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very interesting. I gave him a little bit of history of my life since then, and the fact that I had a wonderful life, and I had a couple of sons and a daughter, and everything was just wonderful.
And I'm sure.
And he told me that he was a CPA and he had two boys working in the office with him, which mm-hmm. made it nice too. And I tried to talk him into coming to that dedication of the World War II memorial back there.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought for a minute. He said, "Well," he says, "he says not if that so and so is going to be there." He says, "I don't want to see him anymore."
And he was referring to the person who had not responded correctly to his concern about the mission and whether it was canceled.
That's right.
Or not.
When they run into that catastrophe over the target on the 28th of December.
But I'm sure, and I don't want to belabor the point here, but in talking to him after all those years, I'm sure it registered in some fashion to you as that could have been your experience. This is what it would have been like for you if you had been shot down and spent 2.5 years as a prisoner of war.
You couldn't help but think about it. Mm-hmm. Of course, yeah.
Made you pretty thankful for the way things worked out.
He told me that he said they had been treated okay while they were prisoners, and that was about all he had to say about it. But he was glad to hear from me, as well as I was happy to hear his voice and get to talk to him. But I couldn't talk him into going to that to that dedication.
I think we all understand why, too. And certainly that's a powerful statement to you that there was a plan for you, that things worked out the way they were supposed to in your life. But it wasn't easy the rest of the war, because that was when you were when you suffered the frostbite. I believe that was your 33rd mission, right?
33rd.
And you ended up flying 50.
Uh-huh.
Somewhere along the line, you earned a Distinguished Flying Cross. I don't want you to brag about yourself, but if you can be honest with us about why you earned that Distinguished Flying Cross and tell us the truth about what you did that the Army Air Corps was so impressed with.
All of us wore throat mics so we could keep in contact with one another during a mission.
Sure.
After this one particular mission, the co-pilot was making the head count and come to find out he wasn't getting an answer from the right waist gunner.
Uh-oh.
Asked me to check on him. Come to find out that Flack had cut his oxygen mask. He was out of it. He wasn't getting any air.
And you're the one who discovered this?
No, actually, he discovered it and told me to check that man.
All right.
Which I did. I took a portable oxygen bottle back there, brought him to, got his mask taken care of, and somehow or other they figured that was with the DFC.
Well, sounds like maybe you helped save his life.
That's what they said.
Anything else you want to share with? I can tell you don't want to draw attention to yourself about it, but is there anything else about that experience you want to share in terms of maybe anything he expressed to you afterwards? I imagine he was probably grateful.
He was. I'll tell you, this goes after the war. We're taking a trip up to Montana with the family we have now.
Uh-huh.
This kid is working for Northwest Airlines in the office up there.
All right.
And we stopped by to see him. So we had a great reunion. This was several years later. We both had families. His wife had us to a nice dinner, and then they showed us where we could. We had a camper with us, and they escorted us out the Columbia River to a nice campsite out there, right near the dam,
mm-hmm.
Where we spent the night. And we did. We had a great reunion. This many years later, we both had small children to accompany us. That to me was that kind of just finished off the whole, it made the connection complete.
Mm-hmm. You could see in each other's lives the opportunities that you had that you almost didn't have.
Right.
So that was the Distinguished Flying Cross that you earned there because he was hit by flak and you helped him. You have a Purple Heart yourself. There's got to be a story behind that.
Yeah, that came from the top turret. We've got a plexiglass canopy.
Right.
On one particular mission, I had that canopy blown off. Shrapnel and all cut up my face a little bit, and that's what accounted for the Purple Heart.
Now you just described that very matter-of-factly, and that's your style. I understand that. You've told your whole story that way, but you're up there in the turret and you're always seeing stuff going on, and you're firing at things and things are firing at you. Did you have any warning that something like that was going to happen? What was that like in the moment? Did you just see a flash and hear a bang and didn't know what was going on, or what was that like?
It happens. You're so busy trying not to burn up those barrels on the twin 50s.
Mm-hmm.
It happens and you don't know. It's just a flash in the pan. That turret was going round after that, according to our flight engineer. Now, Frechette believed in the flight engineer standing behind the pilot and co-pilot.
Okay.
And when I crawled down out of that, I went right to the back of the Frechette up here in the cockpit, and I tapped him on the shoulder. He turned around and he says, Wayne, he says, I can't believe it. I didn't expect to see you standing there.
He thought you were dead.
I don't know what he thought, but that was his reaction.
He knew the turret had been hit,
mm-hmm.
and the force of that hit sent it spinning in circles?
Uh-huh.
So he thought you were not going to be in walking shape for sure.
Apparently so.
Was your vision impaired at all?
No.
You just had blood all over your face, probably.
Uh-huh.
How long did it take you to recover from that?
Not very long. We were still over enemy territory.
So you still had to complete your duties the rest of the mission?
That's right.
You got back up in the turret with no plexiglass lid?
Right.
Sorry, I'm just picturing myself in your shoes.
What else could you do?
Not that the plexiglass is going to save you, although maybe it did in that case.
You don't know.
Is it fair to say that's the only mission you ever flew without the plexiglass lid on that top turret?
That's the only time.
Was that any different for you being up there? Did you feel less secure, or did you feel at this point nothing's going to get you?
It's pretty drafty.
I imagine it was. You're going to get frostbite on your face again like that. Wow. I'll tell you, it's some incredible stuff, and you tell it because you've been telling it for a long time and you lived it, but I think the rest of us are really impressed and blown away, no pun intended, by what you're talking about. Well, Wayne, I know that it's been a lot of years, and it was a lot of years before you had all your medals the way you wanted them to, and Congressman Nunes was helpful in that regard. I want to ask you about, though, coming home from the war. When you got those 50 missions in and you got to come home, was that something you were pretty excited about? Were you a little hesitant because you didn't want to leave your buddies behind? What was that like for you?
There was a contingent of 300 of us. We all came back at the same time, and we were given a 30-day delay en route instead of a furlough, because what they had in mind was giving us 30-day delay en route to go home without charging it to a furlough and then placate us, so to speak. They wanted us to come back and start another tour. And we had three full bird colonels in this group of 300. They spent their entire 30 days in Washington, D.C., going round and round with the brass there, telling them that that was not the way to run the war. Because prior to this, when a person completed his missions, he was given 6 months at home prior to being sent to the other theater. I guess the situation all changed. We were really getting to our purpose in being there.
Right.
And so they figured, well, they sent us home for 30 days and bring us back and have us fly another tour. Well, they couldn't convince the brass in Washington not to do it, so we all reported back to Norfolk to board a ship to go back after 30 days. We got back to Oran, North Africa, which was a staging area where they brought the new troops in prior to sending them to their outfits, because it's the first time they'd tried this. So they put us off in one particular area in Oran and gave each one of us a 24-hour pass, permanent, that we could go and come as we pleased until they decided what to do with us.
All right.
The generals from the 8th Air Force and the 15th Air Force flew back and forth trying to figure out what to do. We spent the entire summer in Oran waiting for their decision.
Sounds like a pretty good vacation.
Yeah, if you can call North Africa a nice place to spend a vacation.
So eventually they made up their mind.
Eventually they made up their mind, decided, well, it wasn't the right thing to do, so they sent us all home.
And you weren't fighting them on that?
No, we didn't argue the point at all.
Was it emotional for you to get home and see your wife again?
Of course it was. We went back. I tell you, there was never a more enduring sight than waking up one morning and seeing the lady, the Statue of Liberty, there in New York Harbor as we were guided down to Fort Dix, New Jersey.
What did that mean to you when you saw that Statue of Liberty?
Oh, it was a beautiful sight. Beautiful, beautiful.
Kind of reminded you of what you were fighting for?
Yes, definitely.
And I imagine there were a few times in those 50 missions, especially when your turret gets blown up and you've got shrapnel in your face, that you wondered if you'd ever see your wife again.
Well, somehow or other, that didn't enter into the situation.
Didn't have time to go there.
No,
huh?
No.
It sounds to me like you're pretty thankful that you've been able to have the life you've had for the last 60 years.
Definitely, I've had a wonderful life, really.
And one thing you've been up to lately, we're almost out of time in the show, but I like to support other efforts around the area, preserving stories and helping veterans process what they've been through, preserving those stories for future generations. And you're involved in a class in Clovis with a great friend of mine named Janice Stevens, who's been doing this for a while, helping veterans write their memoirs, and you've written down your experiences. What do you get out of that class? And what would you say to someone who's maybe heard about it and said, I'm not sure if I want to do that?
I tell you, it's a very interesting class. There's just a few of us WW2 boys there. The bulk of the fellows that come, I'd say probably every week there's 50 or 60 vets show up every Monday morning. Mm-hmm. And the bulk of them are Vietnam and Korea. There's 12, 15 of us from WW2. But they do have some very interesting stories. It lets you know that this wonderful land of ours is worth fighting for. We're so fortunate to be in this country.
Amen.
After hearing some of these stories.
Amen. Couldn't have said that better. And I'll put some information about that class on our website at kmjnow.com. Wayne, I'm sure we haven't covered it all, but as time runs out here on us, is there anything else that you'd like to share about your time in World War II? Why you did what you did and what you're most proud of?
Well, I'm just thankful that I could participate, and that I'm more than thankful for the good Lord seeing me through it.
Absolutely. I'm thankful for that too. Otherwise, I wouldn't have had a chance to sit here with you and enjoy some of your stories. And it's clear from everything you've shared that he was definitely looking out for you. That's the program today. Wayne, thank you for serving our country, and thanks for being here.
Thank you, Paul. I enjoyed it.
Me too, and I know our listeners have as well. If you want to go back and listen to this later, we'll make sure to have the podcast version posted at kmjnow.com. You can also follow Hometown Heroes on Facebook. Thanks for listening today. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.